Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. While most of the attention in November's midterm elections was directed at what party would control each chamber in Congress, there were other very important things happening at the state and local levels, all across the nation. My guest today is one of America's leading observers of politics and policy at the state level. Alan Greenblatt is a reporter for Governing Magazine. He also writes longer-form pieces on trends and developments in state government and politics and the relation between the federal government and the states. Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Grant. It's good to be with you.
So let me just start with your basic impressions. I mean, what do you think was the main storyline from the state elections that took place during the midterms? Did they tell us anything on the whole about the country's political mood or inclinations at the state level that we didn't already know?
Well, I think maybe it was a reaffirmation of things we already knew. Mm. It did seem to me that the partisans kind of went to their separate corners. So the blue states in general got bluer. The red states stayed quite red. As at the congressional level, Democrats made some gains, and they were primarily in suburban districts. But the map, to me, looked so much like the presidential map of 2012. We had some Democratic gains in the Midwest that we could talk about in more detail. But no, in general, we still are two Americas in voting in different directions, I guess.
Well, one of the things that I was really keen to ask you about, and just in terms of the general trends and patterns, and maybe it's a reflection of what you just said about the polarization, but I can never remember in my lifetime, and certainly the 26 years I've been here in the state of New York, I can never remember state elections that were so focused on a president or on national politics. I mean, if you weren't here in New York during the entire lead up to this, but if you didn't know any better, you would think that Governor Cuomo was running against Donald Trump, and you would have thought that a lot of state assembly members were running against Donald Trump. How much do you think national issues and President Trump in particular drove the state level elections?
Quite a lot. I mean, we've seen in recent years kind of a trend toward voting patterns becoming more nationalized. There used to be the cliche, all politics is local, now all politics is national. And so not just Trump, but Nancy Pelosi was featured in ads for people running for state legislative races who obviously don't have anything directly to do with Congress. But certainly Trump was the main focus on the Republican side. In Republican in governor's primaries, there were loyalty to Trump was almost the main qualification that they talked up about themselves. And, of course, as you say, conversely, the Democrats such as Cuomo promised to be a block against the president. Molly Kelly, who ended up losing the governor's race in New Hampshire as a Democrat, she ran an op-ed in the Concord Monitor the Sunday before the election saying, "We need a governor who will stand up to President Trump." But all over the country, you could find examples of this where, you know, Andrew Gillum in Florida, the Democrat, was saying he wanted to abolish ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's something no governor can do. You had Republican governors weighing in on the Kavanaugh nomination and confirmation to the Supreme Court. Governors play no role whatsoever. But we're seeing this more and more. It's, I think, partly the media culture and partly the partisanship. People are so focused on what's happening in Washington. That's always been the case to some extent, but it's more so now. There are fewer papers and certainly TV stations covering state capitals, and people are so transfixed with this president that he sucks up all the oxygen to reach for a cliche. And so you had people who were running who it wasn't clear what they wanted to do if they got the job of governor, because they were talking so much about national issues and President Trump.
You know, there's two questions that I want to put to you that come out of your answer there about the way that state politics relates to national politics. The first one is just in terms of these elections, how much of that phenomenon do you think at the state level was because of calibrations that candidates were making about this is the way that my message will be most effective, this will be the most popular thing that I can say in order to get elected, or versus those national considerations are really driving what the state politics are about? Because as you just said at the end, sometimes it was hard to know what a gubernatorial candidate was really going to do in terms of his or her agenda if they were elected. So what was the connect? Was there a disconnect between the actual substance of the policies that needed to be discussed in the states, or has the national conversation taken that over? I don't know if that question makes sense, but it seems like there's a dichotomy.
Well, I have some thoughts. So there are a couple things. One is you often had candidates insist they weren't running for or against Trump. I mean, Republicans in the primaries talked a lot about, I'm the most loyal Trump supporter. And then in the general election, often they said, I have this plan for roads. Or, you know, they did pivot to state issues to some extent, but their advertising was typically national issues. We had several Republican candidates for governor running ads about the caravan of migrants coming up from Central America, which, you know, if you're in Pennsylvania, it's a long walk from Honduras or even from the Mexico border. But that was, you know, an issue that they felt motivated their supporters. But often you'd have candidates say, look, I'm not running against Trump. Even though they were running ads against Trump, they would say, my focus is on delivering health care. My focus is on making schools better, you know, the traditional issues. And often, though, the voters would talk about Trump. I don't know how many millions of stories I read about campaigns around the country where you'd have the campaign manager insist, we're running on health care, and that's what people care about. And then they would quote somebody who'd attended that rally saying, I am so terrified of Trump, you know, if they're Democrat. He's an authoritarian, you know, all the things you kind of hear. So definitely people were motivated by it. But, you know, this is a little bit in the weeds, but just to mention briefly, traditionally, there aren't that many groups that concern themselves with state races and particularly state legislative races. There's always a national committee for the Republicans and the Democrats for legislative races, and certainly for governors, they have their fundraising arms. But this cycle, there were at least two dozen new groups on the Democratic side run for something, sister district, flippable, forward majority, the arena, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, many of which only played in two or three states. But there was this flowering of people who were so frustrated, and they felt like they were Democrats. As Democrats, they felt shut out of power in Washington. They felt like they had to do something. And they, you know, Republicans were always smarter about paying attention to state races. It's hard to get anyone to focus on them. It's hard to raise money for them unless it's a redistricting cycle. But Republicans understood the power of them. And, Republicans have really dominated state government in this decade. They went into Tuesday's election this election with twice as many governors in twice as many legislative chambers. And they'd really worked it. And Democrats only got the message, it seems like now, that states matter partly for redistricting but partly for their own issues. And Eric Holder, who was Barack Obama's attorney general, started a group called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee that was specifically raising millions of dollars to support primarily governors, but in the states where they think redistricting will be they can make more favorable after the 2020 census.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Alan Greenblatt, a reporter with Governing Magazine, and we're discussing the midterm election results at the state and local levels. You know, the other question that struck me as you were talking about some of the things that you've observed at the state level is in the relationship then with the national conversation, and particularly President Trump. You know, one of the arguments for having the states at all is that it allows for variation and it allows for differences. And so a Republican in Vermont is going to be different than a Republican in Texas, and those policy questions will be different. So to the degree that the national conversation kind of blocks out these local and state-based conversations, I think was there a disservice done in the state and local level elections this time around? Because the as you put it, you know, the lack of oxygen to talk about some of these more specific local things?
Well, maybe in terms of the election itself, but the result is we're going to have that federalism experiment, the laboratories of democracy, where states are going to be doing different things. And it's not so much that Vermont is still different from Texas, although that's certainly true. It's more that at the state level, the parties have split power. So in Congress, that happened as well. Democrats took the House and Republicans kept the Senate. So we're going to have gridlock in Washington. It's going to be very ugly. There'll be a lot of subpoenas and investigations and the president responding in kind and so forth. And the Mueller investigation denouement, I'm sure, will be quite divisive. But at the state level, there's almost this perfect split. I mean, Republicans still have more states, but we have, after this election, Minnesota is the only state in the country with a divided legislature, with the House and Senate, mainly because the Democrats took the House and the Senate wasn't up this time. It was a four-year term there. So that's a little obscure point, but this hasn't happened since 1914, where there's only one divided legislature in the country. So Republicans have 33 legislatures. Democrats, let's see if I can do the math, 16. And with what we call trifectas, where the one party has the governor and the legislature, I believe the numbers are Republicans have 24 states, maybe it's 23 states, and Democrats have 14. So then there are a few states with split control, but mainly they're either Democratic or Republican, and we're going to see opposite policy agendas. I mean, here in New York, the Democrats took real control. They had a numerical majority in the state Senate, but now they have an actual working majority because there was this rump group that worked with Republicans and blocked a lot of Democratic legislation. We're going to see things flow through. So, for instance, there's a desire among Democratic state senators here to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution or somehow pass pro-abortion legislation. Conversely, you know, on the ballot in West Virginia and I'm blanking on the other state, but two states had constitutional amendments on their ballots that banned abortion from their state constitutions. So the thinking is if the Supreme Court with, you know, a more conservative majority now may, if not overturn, certainly weaken Roe v. Wade, there are going to be state, you know, red states are going to be pushing this envelope. Last spring, Iowa passed a fetal heartbeat bill, which effectively banned almost all abortions. So this, the red states are going to be testing how far the courts will go in terms of limiting abortion, even as the blue states are trying to protect abortion. And you could go down the list on a lot of issues. We're going to have a lot of policies at the state level in opposite directions.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Governing Magazine's Alan Greenblatt. Alan writes on state and local politics and policy and the relation between the federal government and the states. Back to the election results. Did anything happen at the state level in the midterms that just flat out surprised you, you didn't see coming, and you really were surprised to see?
There were not really huge surprises. It was kind of a middling result. Typically, the president's party loses power in the midterms. That's a very – it's almost like an iron law of politics. There are a couple of exceptions, but really only a couple going back 100 years or so. So Democrats did gain seats, but not that many. So there were 6,600 legislative seats up out of – it was about 80% of all of them in the country. And Democrats gained 350, which was not tremendous because the average for the president's party is to lose 425. So they fell below the historical average. It was not only not a big wave, but it was actually less than normal.
Less than normal.
And Democrats picked up seven chambers around the country, but often they were kind of the short putt ones. For instance, here in New York, they just needed one seat. They got a few extra. In Connecticut, the Senate was tied. They got a few extra. The Colorado Senate, they needed one. The Maine Senate, they needed one. So and in, there are other states where they gained a lot, Democrats did, Pennsylvania, Texas, where a lot of Republicans got wiped out, as we were saying earlier, at the suburban level, the suburbs of Philadelphia, the suburbs of Houston, Republicans got wiped out. But the Republicans kept their majorities in those states because they built up such huge majorities. So there was not really a tremendous amount of turnover. And then I don't think we've mentioned at the governor's level, Democrats also gained seven there, which was, you know, a good number. So Republicans went in with twice as many, and now it's 27-23. So Democrats caught up pretty well and won some big states, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan, for example. And if I'm a Democrat, I'm looking at some of the results in these upper Midwest states and thinking about 2020, because where Democrats picked up governorships were mainly states that had switched from Obama to Trump from 2012 to 2016. So not only did they win the governor in Wisconsin and Michigan, and the Democratic governor in Pennsylvania got reelected pretty handily, but they won the U.S. Senate races in all those states. So when you look at the map as a Democrat, you think, oh, the Electoral College, maybe the Midwest is not gone forever. There's a lot of talk about that after Trump, you know, took over that region. And there's so much talk about should the Democrats look at the Sun Belt instead. Well, they did make some gains in the Sun Belt. They did pretty well, like, say, in Texas, in Arizona, states like that. But the Midwest appears at the moment, and midterms are not good predictors of the presidential race 2 years later, but at least they're not dead in the Midwest.
And what about the policy implications of the results at the state level in the midterms? Is there a new kind of set of proposals or impact that you see likely to be either hitting governors' desks from legislatures or being pushed by governors? I mean, one thing that struck me immediately as you were just talking about some of those gubernatorial results is that perhaps we might see further expansions of Medicaid, more states taking the federal government up on the Obamacare deal for Medicaid. But I don't know if there's other big ones that you see out there on the way.
Yeah, a lot of the Democrats ran on either expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act or protecting what was already there, because Republicans at first were saying they might abolish it, and then as the elections went on, they said, no, I'm going to protect the coverage of pre-existing conditions. And on the ballot, Idaho, Utah, and Nebraska all voted for Medicaid expansions. So, and that had actually happened in Maine last year. The voters approved a Medicaid expansion, which the outgoing Republican governor, Paul LePage, blocked.
Right.
So the new governor is a Democrat, Janet Mills. That's going to be the first order of business there. And, you know, watching states in the last couple of years, Republicans took over a lot of state legislatures and governorships in 2010. And they've had a tremendous amount of policy success with conservative proposals on abortion, on voter ID restrictions, on tax cuts, on school choice, and on down the list, right to work, et cetera. In the last couple of years, I felt like the red states were not putting out that many ideas. Not a lot was coming across my radar that I thought was interesting or innovative. And I wondered whether, you know, the lobbyists had shifted their attention to Washington because Republicans had taken complete control of the presidency and the Congress. I'm wondering how much of the action now goes back to states, because it's going to be a lot easier to get things done at the state level for conservatives and progressives as well in separate states.
That's interesting. It's interesting to think about how the lobbying groups factor into that. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Alan Greenblatt, a reporter for Governing Magazine. Different kind of question about the state and local elections. For Congress in this set of midterms, the Democrats really emphasized the candidacies of women and also as a subset, women with some kind of military experience. And this was a banner year for women in Congress. I think there'll be a record number of women serving in the House and in Congress generally. Were the parties doing anything in similar kind of veins at the state and local level, either the Democrats or the Republicans, looking for certain kinds of candidates to try to put forward for some important seats?
Well, there was certainly a big year for women at the state level. There's no question about it. Just as with Congress, there were record numbers of women who ran for state legislatures and for governors. The previous record for women nominated as by a major party for governor was 10. This year we had 16. So on a percentage basis, it's obviously huge. And we had 4 women governors reelected and 5 new women governors elected. So that ties the all-time record. We've never had more than 9 women serving as governor at the same time. At the legislative level, it's even bigger. Women reached just shy of 25% of the legislative seats about 20 years ago, and they've been stuck there ever since. And only this year with some special elections did they just get over 25%. And after this election, they're in the mid-30s.
Wow. 35-36%,
a huge jump, mostly on the Democratic side. Most of the women were running as Democrats. We saw that with voters. A lot of women were uncomfortable with this president. Some of them were motivated enough to run for office themselves. I don't know the exact number now, but going into the election at the House, the U.S. House, the Republican caucus was 85% white males, and that's going up. And the Democratic caucus was 45% white males, and that's going down. So the parties are definitely shifting on a demographic basis, certainly by race, but also by gender.
There's a theory in political science that I know that you're familiar with in thinking about the number of women in Congress and looking at the number of women in state legislatures in terms of this pipeline theory, and that's one of the explanations why the percentage doesn't go up, because you're not seeing the supply of potential candidates who are qualified at the state level. I wonder if this huge boost you're talking about, which I think is a story that's not been reported enough in the national media, will have an effect in cementing that female representation and maybe even expanding it in Congress in the future.
Well, obviously, if you have more women on the playing field, you're going to have more women playing. I mean, to use it not a great metaphor. Certainly, some of these women will go on to big careers. Ilhan Omar, the first Somali, she was one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress this year from Minnesota, first anywhere in the country. She was just elected as a state rep 2 or 4 years ago, I forget. So obviously people like that will move up. And one little factoid that really struck me was in New Mexico, there was a Republican woman who was governor named Susana Martinez. She was succeeded by a Democratic congresswoman named Michelle Lujan Grisham. It's the first state to elect two women in a row.
Oh, interesting.
There's certainly a bigger pool of women running. And like I say, the political science literature suggests women, when they run, win as often as men. They just don't run as often.
Mm. And thinking about then where the two parties find themselves at the state and local level, I want to put you in the role of political strategist now. Thinking about the situation that they have, what do you think are the two parties' best approaches to take at the state level from a politically strategic point of view over the next couple years? Do they have the same set of incentives? Do they have a different kind of set of factors that each of them need to take into account?
You know, one thing that I've been thinking about is whether Democrats have a ceiling at the state level. As I said, their votes come mainly in urban districts, and now they've made further inroads into the suburbs, and particularly the kind of Whole Foods sort of suburbs with affluent people. But as I said, their gains were not huge, and they were mostly in states you'd kind of expect. And so Republicans remain dominant at the state level despite this. And, you know, it's sort of like people can picture this with the Electoral College. They're more underpopulated states that are well represented in the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate. Something like that is happening at the state level as well. Within states, Democrats have a hard time winning except in these very densely clustered areas, which then are often exacerbated by redistricting. So there may be a ceiling for Democrats at the state level.
And what you're saying, in a sense, if I understand it then, is that they're winning by bigger and bigger margins, but it's not necessarily going to translate into more seats in the chamber. Is that it?
Yeah, like one statistic, Democrats actually won more votes in U.S. House races in Ohio than Republicans, but they only took 4 out of the 16 seats. Mm-hmm. So their voters are not efficiently distributed, as we say. They tend to be clustered in the major cities. You have districts where Democrats are winning with 90%. You have 2 or 3 of those, and then 6 or 8 Republican seats where they're winning with 55%. So Republicans spread their votes more evenly and have more turf to work with and come out with a higher number of seats.
And this goes back to something we were talking about earlier at the beginning when you were discussing the kinds of campaigns that some of the gubernatorial candidates ran and how the messaging was very nationally oriented, president-oriented, and then also sometimes how it shifted when you went from the primary to the general election. I wanted to ask you a question to expand on that a little bit in thinking about the state and local level elections in terms of the kinds of political messaging and their effectiveness. And in particular, one of the things I wanted to ask you to reflect on is the tendency toward an attack kind of messaging and attack kind of ads. Here in this congressional district and in this general area here of upstate New York, we saw some pretty sharp-edged congressional messaging, some of it kind of different from what the same candidate had done in previous elections. And so what did you see at the state level in that regard? Did things get nastier, or are they just about the same as they always were?
Well, it's funny. On the one hand, yes, and on the other hand, no. And what I mean by that is there certainly were attacks. There certainly were people who ran. You know, I often was thinking about Hillary Clinton's strategy in 2016, where her message was, Donald Trump is not fit to be president. And that was enough for the popular vote, but not enough to win. She never made a positive case for herself. Maybe she didn't have one. But there were candidates who reminded me of that, where all they did was attack the other person. And that's kind of natural in this political environment. We're very polarized. People are voting on party lines. And, you know, like I said, we're separated by race. We're separated by gender. We're separated by education level. We're separated by geographic area where we live. And so people are not only – we have what we call in your field negative partisanship, where people are motivated mainly by the fear that the other side is so terrible that they're unacceptable. So we do have a lot of politicians playing to that. Having said that, the results were that most of the harder edge candidates on both sides end up losing. Mm. So some of the most Trumpian Republicans end up losing. Chris Kobach in Kansas, for example, who is a very well-known, very ideological type candidate. One of these people who only talked about national issues, not what he wanted to do as governor. He lost to a moderate Democrat. A lot of the new Democrats in Wisconsin and Michigan, they beat more progressive candidates in the primaries, and they ran on the one in Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. Her slogan was practically fix the damn roads. I mean, you couldn't get more nuts and bolts than that, or bread and butter, whatever cliche. So, like I said, a lot of the hard edge conservatives lost, and the very high profile, highly progressive Democrats lost as well, with an exception. Jared Polis in Colorado, who had a ton of money of his own, he won. And then immediately after the election said, oh, this stuff about single payer health care, I didn't really mean it, you know, in so many words. But the very progressive candidates in Maryland and in Arizona, several other states, they end up losing. So we did end up with more moderates tending to win despite all the hard edge attacks.
We only have a couple seconds left, literally a couple seconds. But the last thing I want to ask you is, do you have a favorite state? You covered the whole 50 states. Do you have one favorite state that you like writing about the most for whatever reason?
Maybe Wisconsin. Scott Walker is the governor there who just lost. That state is so polarized. There's so much conflict. It's so evenly matched. It's really a fascinating state to think about.
That was Alan Greenblatt. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, it was really a pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.